Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Adam Barrett.
Hey, Adam.
How's it going, Fred?
Oh, you know, I'm trying to think the last time we talked.
It has been a little bit. It's the holidays, and we just caught up on some of our holiday shenanigans and talked about our fun activities and our family that we enjoyed seeing for a specific short period of time and then had them leave, which everybody has.
Well, there's a this time of year, you often think of the Ben Franklin quote.
Yeah, fish.
Visitors and relatives and fish, or last 3 days or something like that.
No, I think it's family is like fish. They both begin to stink after 3 days.
Yeah, something like that. Only he could say that appropriately.
Yeah, but it's spot on and eternal.
It is, but we, got to catch up, got a lot of, quality time and, just in the, it was relaxing. We stayed off the roads mostly. We could hear the sirens on the local freeway, so it was a good choice not to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
I had the crazy freezing weather that was like nuts, like 20 something degrees, 30 degrees below freezing. It's just like,
It's good for you. Yeah, that's why I like calling you in January up from here in California. It's a good time.
I'm making the most of it, though. I sent you pictures of because I live in the lake. So I sent you pictures of ice skating, and there's this section of ice that was crystal clear. I sent you a picture of a fish swimming under the ice. Yeah, it was crazy. It was like glass. It was really freaky to go on. It felt like you were standing on top of a building.
Well, that's, they're making walkways now that are glass bottomed and platforms over the Grand Canyon that are glass bottom and stuff.
I went out on that actually last year.
You did?
Yeah, I did. It was pretty neat.
Well, I wonder if they considered how many people get on it or if they all start dancing.
Do you know what surprised me most was that you put on clean room booties before you go out there, which, right? Because that's the thing.
Oh, yeah, you would all cloud it up. Yeah, if you get it all gritty.
Clear from getting scratched and all that. And they actually, it was like, because, I used to work in semiconductor, and there's the clean room procedure where you, put on the booties and you swing your feet over and all this stuff, It was almost the exact same thing. It was the same booties. It was really funny. So everybody's out there with little blue booties walking around on the glass. Yeah.
I wonder how long it took them to figure that out.
About a day, probably, because it's everything sand and dirt out there. It's the Grand Canyon.
It is. I imagine after two steps on the dust, your shoes become sandpaper anyway. I wonder.
Yeah.
They must have to polish that every now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
Was it glass or was it like a plexiglass?
I don't know. I actually don't. I don't know. My guess.
You didn't do a sample? You didn't scrape
it? Yeah, I didn't drill a hole. No, my guess would be glass. If I was designing it to think from a hardness standpoint, of not scratching, I would think glass would be better because you could get the strength you want with glass, and then it has a better chance fighting, scraping up and stuff. But I don't know. Yeah, actually, it's funny. I have a friend that lives near the other side of the lake, and when it first started to really freeze, I walked over there and I brought my drill, a cordless drill, because every so often I drill to see the thickness if it's changing in different parts. And so I did that and I measured, the depth with a little depth gauge. And when I got over, he's like, "Do you realize you made like a serrated, a dotted line for cracking all the way across your connected stress points?"
Did you walk right straight back along the line?
I was like, I walked back a different way.
I often make that statement when people ask me what I do, and I talk about reliability engineering, and I make things break and stuff like that. And then they look at me kind of puzzled, and I said, it makes it tough to get on an airplane sometimes.
That's what you think about.
Yeah, we know too much,
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But you don't always know too much though. It's, that glass, the platform out at the Grand Canyon or how thick the ice is before you drag out your fishing hut, or people, in at least where I grew up in Wisconsin, people would drive out onto the lakes and set up huts and stuff. You know, does 6 inches of ice always mean it's a particular strength? Just depend on the, you know, the freezing conditions. And in, you know, glass or plexiglass or whatever they got over the Grand Canyon, it's, you're in a desert, dude, and it's a high desert, so it gets really cold fast overnight. And just the engineering challenges of in the understanding of those environments is a pretty big deal.
Oh yeah. I mean, and right, exactly. And the thing is, one, have you asked the right questions, you know, and then two, have you fully assessed and characterized and documented what those, you know, parameters are? Because the, you know, the most important definition out there for us in our work, or the most important statement, or actually what I say is my most important slide in my education classes, simply has a definition of reliability on it. Right. And it's the, you know, percentage likelihood of failure over a specific period of time and a specific use case in a specific environment. And all three of those are critical to having the statement having any validity. And so, yeah, exactly. And then it's always shocking to see how many reliability statements I see that really don't have, you know.
Well, it gets assumed. Yeah, it gets assumed oftentimes. Oh, most should survive a year. Or, you know.
I have one of the most, or do I have one of the other ones?
Yeah. Or, you know, if they're really good, then they say 98% should survive 2 years. Often, though, you'll see statements of, oh, it's a five-year product. Or worse, it's an MTBF of something.
2 years of what? Right, 98% will survive 2 years of sitting in, sitting on the desk. Shelf,
yeah, or under on the dashboard, or
actually
being used. You know, our products wouldn't fail if people didn't actually use them. It's kind of a Dilbert approach, I think.
Oh, customers are so annoying.
Well, they are, you know. But the point is, one of my favorite books, we were chatting about what we've been reading lately, but this is one I'm sure I've mentioned before. It was Design Paradigms. And Henry Petrosky writes about railroad bridges in the 1800s, the freight lined railroad bridges. And there was new technologies. There was a tubular bridge. They made a big cylinder and laid it across the gap, and they didn't need as much support underneath it because the cylinder itself created the structure. It was a nightmare to go through because all of the steam and byproducts of all the burning coal and everything else would just fill the tube completely. And it would be, it was like 200 feet long. So it was kind of get up a good head of speed and hold your breath as you go.
Jeez.
Through it.
Oh my God.
So and then they made trestle bridges and they made girder bridges and they made all these different styles of bridges were invented every few years to solve different technical problems and different gaps they were trying to span. And the initial designs were done by the eminent architects and designers of the day. And they, those bridges are still standing. It's like the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a huge suspension bridge. It's still standing, right? With the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which was a many years later designed, but it went a little too thin, a little too light, a little too whatever, and ignored the environment that was around it, the wind that was there. Where what Petrosky says is that the initial designers over-design. They don't know the environment. They don't know all the different ways this can fail. It's a brand new concept. And so we're going to make everything really big and beefy. And, you know, they've commissioned me to build a bridge. I don't want it to fall down. They don't want it to fall down. Mm-hmm. We'll pay for the extra cable.
It's why I have all my grandfather's tools in my workshop, because they will never ever, there'll be archaeological finds in a thousand years, the way they're built. It's ridiculous.
That's right. Right. So it's part of that is by having uncertainty. So you build in margin, right? It wasn't that they designed, they wanted to make a bridge that would last 100 years in a day. They wanted a bridge that would last, and they didn't really know how long. And then what Petrosky says that happens, and while these various bridges like the Tacoma Narrows fell down, is that the original designer teaches his apprentices and his immediate followers, and they go off and they design bridges. And now everybody's designing bridges, and it's taught in school. And those trestle bridges are easy. Here, kid, you make this bridge. And he goes 1 foot too far, and it collapses on the first train that went across it. And so they whittled away the margins that were built in originally without understanding the loads it would see in these railroad bridges in particular. Mm. And
it's
see
not just
it in,
the loads. They don't study variability is what I see.
Oh, yeah. No, it is all kinds of stuff. But it applies to all kinds of products. You don't put your top designer on putting capacitors on the circuit board.
Mm.
They're working on the ASICs. They're working on the analog circuitry. They're working on the tough stuff, right? But capacitors cause a lot of failures.
Mm.
You know, if you put it too close to a breakoff tab, if you do it, you know, there's lots of ways they can break. Yet it's very common that design teams put their newest people on the commodity parts of the product. And part of this is we don't spend the time to understand the environment, you understand the stresses and how it's going to be used. It's going back to environments is, do you think the folks at Apple and other cell phone makers thought people would get their phones wet when they first designed them? I mean, the very first phones.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. This is answer your question a long way, starting back with a comment from earlier, is like my grandfather's tools, right? So what's the difference? Actually, I have a blog post on it I did where I took photographs of my equivalent tools and, mm-hmm. and his, like mm-hmm. wrenches and metal shears. And, you know, you don't have to state the obvious, right? That mine are clearly not going to be handed down probably. They wear out and I'll probably have to replace them.
Well, just don't use them.
Just don't use them. Exactly. Although I think you know how I use tools.
Yeah.
Whatever they said the use case was, I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
So it's a great hammer, but it wasn't a hammer.
That's right. I've seen your used tools. I know exactly what this is.
But what you're seeing is optimization, I think. So the reason why you don't see they build it like they used to is because they build it like they used to, you wouldn't have bought it. Do you know how much it costs to make a wrench the way like that wrench is designed? It's like five times the amount of material and, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, over-designed. So what occurs over time is that as people get better and better at it and understanding and actually studying use case, studying variabilities on stresses, you can optimize the design and begin to be like, we can compete on cost, right? Knowing that a consumer like myself as a target market is going to put cost over durability because of my use case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only going to use the shears two or three times a month. I'm not a contractor using them for 4 hours a day every day.
So the long-term wear out mechanisms and the hinge elongating, mm-hmm. for example, that's the pivot point.
Right.
That might take years for a contractor even to cause that to wear out. Where for you, it's just not going to happen. So if they use aluminum instead of cast iron, it'll wear faster, but it'll still be years in your circumstance.
Right. His product and my product may wear out at the same time, right? And it's because the designer took the time to analyze a use case, mm-hmm. you know, how is it used? And we're able to then specialize it for a very specific market. And in my case, I'm not going to pay five times the cost of what I did for my shears because
grandfather's version of it.
I got my grandfather's still. And, you know, but the thing is that I probably wouldn't buy a pair if I had, you know, I'd be like, I probably won't really use them that much. You know, I could borrow my neighbor. So they were able to make the sale by being like, hey, we can make it, you know, this much less durable because we've clearly defined this use case, which is the regular homeowner, you know.
And it's balanced by that it still works. It provides the function with turning a bolt or something.
Right.
It works well enough to that you get your perceived value from that particular tool. And it's relative, right, of how we expect to use it. And then it starts that you need to understand the environment well enough because you don't want to cheap it out so much that it just doesn't work.
Exactly. So are you studying? Because over-engineering and under-engineering are both lazy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have done the work. And that comes down to taking the time to define use case. Because even within engineering teams, I see different definitions just because nobody's defined it. So a test will be designed to make a statement, a reliability statement on something. And obviously the testing stresses and the statement are based on some use case. Mm-hmm. And the people who are reading the results have a different use case in mind within the same company. Okay. So effectively the results they're reading don't apply based on their assumptions. So it really behooves everybody to invest that time in doing that, because it's not just external to the company, you know, the customers, that it's valuable internally.
This isn't new by any means. I mean, the Mill Standards had, I don't know, like a five, or I don't know, maybe on the order of 10 different environments that they quantified: ground benign, aircraft in the cabin, and aircraft outside the cabin, space. They had a bunch of them. And then it goes on to say, well, here's the stresses. Here's the types of things that go into it. But what the problem is that that's one set of environments, and it's for military products used worldwide, and it kind of covers the worst of all extremes. But it doesn't say how often the plane flew or how often the track vehicle was operated. It doesn't mm-hmm. give us the use part. So
right.
I think the main point is you got to do both. And how often is it idle? How often is it in storage? How often is it in direct sunlight? How often is it in high humidity? It's the day in the life of a product is not just some grand average and we hope it works. And there's so many stories of people designing stuff in the in the middle of Denver, Colorado, and it doesn't work at the coast. It doesn't work at lower altitude. It doesn't work in 220 volt environments, because the only environment they saw and characterized was the one in their lab without right. on their bench. And it can, but writing it down, and we often would write down light users and heavy users or whatever made sense from the marketing guys. Heaven forbid we got to go talk to the marketing guys, but their job is to understand the customer and what problem they're trying to solve. And part of that is, where are they doing it? How often are they doing it? What are their expectations? They should never go to your basement and your workshop to see how you use stuff. But
no, I'm the guy they should go see. They should look and be like, is what he just did within our use case when he comes back and says it broke? I mean, that's actually the exact opposite. I'm right. the type of person you should try to study.
Well, then I have to pay more for your wrench being used as a hammer. Come on.
No. I'm not saying that I have to have success with the product. They just have to have looked at that and made a decision. Do you kind of get what I'm saying?
Yeah. There's due diligence there for just, is it safe, right? If you use that wrench as a hammer and it fractured and flew up and poked your eye out, it's not the tool's fault.
Did they study it enough to make that statement in advance? They should have come and seen that, hey, look at this. People like this guy who do this. We should make a statement that if you do this, you know, don't.
Yeah, don't.
Just don't.
Well, so I bought a chainsaw recently, and I was looking up how to tighten the chain on it. And it was a, I don't know, maybe a 50-page operating manual. I counted. There was 38 pages of warnings. Mm-hmm. It was mind numbing, mm-hmm. You know, don't use this for amputation. Okay. Right. It would work, right. But you know, don't, you know, and it went on and on and on and on. Yep. But if you buy a wrench, you don't get an user's manual.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. So how's that going to work?
Hold on. Let's talk. Are we talking about liability or customer satisfaction? Because that's two different things. From a liability standpoint, if you didn't write it down somewhere.
If you're designing a new wrench, right, a new tool, and you're recommending that they come see you to see how their tool could be used, and kind of we're using it as an extreme case. And as part of the process of understanding the environment and use conditions that it could see. Now, it will definitely inform them, and it will expand where the set of stresses they should expect their product to experience. And then they have to make a decision. Is it cost effective to do that or not? But, you know, is that more what you're going after, is that they should understand the full range and then make conscious decisions?
I'm talking about intelligent decision. It is really, if you're going to sum up what I'm getting at, it's intelligent decisions with regard to your product. So here's an example. So you could just design a cordless drill that you want to have a good, you know, and one of the things important is a good cost point. Mm-hmm. And so obviously you're looking to minimize, which means you really have to study. So your case study has people using it either inside or outside or things like that. Now, what if you were to then study and find out, wait a minute, it does fine out in cold weather outside. For me, when I say outside, I think of cold. Mm-hmm. It does fine outside in cold weather. It does fine inside a room temperature. But what about the case study where you had it in your car and traveled somewhere and then taking it out of the car and going in, and it's in the temperature, it's cold, but being used inside. You know, so mm-hmm. let's say that causes an issue. And at that point, you then you find a design solution for it, but it adds cost. So you have a couple choices. Do you want to, you could create two levels of the product, the regular and the heavy duty. And if people who really want to just save costs and are just going to leave it in their shop drawer would get the super cheap, but you'd have the middle level, you know, heavy duty one for people, you know, who are going to do that type of thing with it. So you've made you've clearly targeted two specific types of markets. Or it could simply be that you choose, like, do you know what? It's not reasonable for us to believe anybody would be satisfied with something that can't do this. So mm-hmm. we should add this, you know.
Well, that comes with the understanding of how often that scenario would happen. How much of a change in temperature does that mean? If you go from the garage where it's not air conditioned to in-house where it is air conditioned or vice versa, is that enough to cause a problem? Or is it only in the Arctic blast going from minus 30 to, you know, to 70 degrees in front of the fireplace? Is that the delta change that causes the problem? You're right. It's a lot of studying, but it's one part is understanding. I think it's iterative, though. It's not just go, oh, people are going to use this at home and it's going to be indoors and outdoors and it's portable. It's, well, what are the failure mechanisms that set of stresses and the various ways it can be used? And you just painted a couple of scenarios that would excite failure mechanisms. We got to explore those. And then we have to make intelligent decisions of what are we going to do about it versus all the other constraints on the product's design. Is that?
It
goes back and forth. We don't know all the environments that are relevant until we know how it fails. And we don't know how it fails until we have a pretty good idea of how it's going to be used. So maybe they should start at your lab, your shop. And
exactly. No, I mean, it really is, because it's arrogant to think you could sit down in a meeting room and come up with all the different possible, you know, variabilities and condition. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. I once read a really interesting thing about Toyota's designing of the Sienna minivan mm-hmm. and how they wanted it to just dominate the market. And they had one engineer who came over and he didn't bring a van. He just took a generic minivan he was able to rent in America. Mm-hmm. And he drove it all through North America, everywhere, all through Canada, and the whole time just taking notes. And, you know, that's just because they were like, you know what, there's no way we're going to speculate on all the possible variations and use case, you know, because they're mostly mm-hmm. looking at use case, you know,
probably watching other people using it too, going to the store, going to the shop, right, going to wherever.
And I think at some point what was the thing? Like he wanted to simulate family. So I think he had like his family or other people come over for a period of time. And I think at some point he just, like, I don't know, rented a family, you know, around, like, just to things
hey,
like,
you guys want to go for a ride?
Yeah. It just was like, and it was things like, wow, you really do need extra cup holders, you know, and, you know, just things that would happen. And mm-hmm. it was just being aware that investment up front it takes a lot of work. It's hard to sell because the ROI is a little abstract. It's easy for somebody to counter that very big expense by being like, no, we're smart. Well, you know, we know what we're doing.
That's right.
But the return on investment's insane, right? And that was a very successful product mm-hmm, in the mm-hmm. end. A lot of it is because of that. So
I was amazed it had 17 cup holders, the version I bought.
Yeah, right. There you go. Yeah.
You know, okay, and so that car lasted 20 years.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. And, yeah, it's interesting. I always love reading that kind of stuff. I actually, because I have a 40-year-old sports car that I love, I adore. And I've one of the things I got, God, I'm such a dork. One of the things I got for Christmas, I'll just admit it, and I asked for it, was not just a book about the car, but a book that somebody summarized all the engineering, like the whole engineering project.
Oh, okay.
Of the thing too. Like, so like the project plan, things that happened, their testing and whatever. And
right.
And I got it for Christmas. Santa brought it. And it was really interesting seeing, like, it had their notes. Actually, it had the sheets of the failures, like, from when they were driving. And they wanted – the big thing was to have this market car be successful in North America. And this was 1969. So the Japanese really were very disconnected from our culture and, you know, what our products were like. And they were trying to figure it out. And they just took one of them and the notes from driving through the Colorado mountains and going from, you know, desert to cold and like that. It was really interesting, like how it changed their whole thing with their, you know, their defrosting stuff and all these different things. And there's no way they would have captured that in Japan. Like, it just would have – there's no way – there's so many things there they would have never caught, you know, unless you went through the deserts and in the Midwest, you know.
If you don't experience road dust number – Arizona road dust, you haven't experienced road dust.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's – and so I guess that's kind of what I'm advising. And I just, you know, as a consultant, see it over and over again of that, trying to convince people to do that investment up front to fully characterize the use cases and fully characterize the environment, because there's no reliability statement that's valuable if you can't complete the definition, the three terms of time, use case, and environment. It's really a meaningless number.
Well, I'm going to say we need to get another cup of coffee and keep talking. I'm going to wrap this one up, because I fully suspect that one or more of our listeners are going to say, well, how do you justify that expense? How do you actually go about doing it? We're not Toyota, and we're not sending an engineer off for a year on a prototype to check it out. Very few companies have that luxury. So we need to come back and talk about how to do this in a range of different products.
I can definitely share my experiences on that. And it's,
all right. Well, let's come back to that, and we'll let people get out of their cars, out of their drive, you know, get into work or whatever you're going. And we'll be back with our next episode on how do you actually do this? Does that make sense? We'll do that.
Yep. Let's do it.
All right. Cool. So if you've got questions along that lines, never fear. We're going to actually probably turn the tape off and turn it right back on and keep talking about how to do it. So look forward to on in the next episode. And if we miss something that you're interested in this one, or if you had a question or a comment or whatever, we'd love hearing from people that are listening to the show. So don't be shy. We'd love hearing from you. We'll respond to any questions you give us and more than likely make them into a podcast episode in addition to getting back to you. So head over to reliability.fm. And we look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Adam, you taking notes about how to do this?
Nope, I don't need to.
You got
I've
it,
lived too many times, yeah.
All right, well, we'll be right back then with that.
Bye.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.